From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on the morning of September 9th, 2016. It was the day that Assemblyman Bill Nogay was due to turn himself in on a federal fraud charge, a charge that he had embezzled roughly $1 million. The victim was Nogay's longtime friend, a local architect. Now, Nogay never showed up in court, of course. Instead, he went to the plot of a family gravesite and shot himself to death. After he died, some of his supporters argued that the court documents should remain sealed. After all, Nogay was gone. What good would it do to force these details into the light of the public? But reporters at the Democrat and Chronicle disagreed. And for 5 months, Steve Orr and Gary Craig tracked a story that became a sprawling web spanning a couple of continents. What they discovered became the core of a blockbuster report this past weekend. You might have seen it. A lot of praise for the work that they have done. Some compared it, this reporting, to Rochester's version of Spotlight. I've invited the reporters to come on this program and explain how they tracked the information and what questions remain unanswered in this story. So my guests are Steve Orr and Gary Craig. And gentlemen, congratulations on tremendous reporting. Really compelling stuff. So thank you for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
I want to start by quoting from your piece. And this comes from some of the opening paragraphs. Quote, an investigation into Nogay's affairs by the Democrat and Chronicle found just how profoundly the world was closing in on him that day. Nogay, who preached fiscal constraint and moral rectitude from his political soapbox, was about to be revealed as a thief. Just days before he died, he had scammed a huge sum of money from a second friend to repay the first, robbing Peter to pay Paul, end quote. All right, so after Nogay died, I'd love for you to kind of give us a frame for how you set about reporting the story. I mean, in those early hours, there was already speculation from other outlets that, you know, that he was doing in court over the Cambodia deal, which turned out not necessarily to be the case. And you had the name of Bud DeWolf very early on. But kind of give me the sense for those opening days and then weeks, how you started to track all of this.
Yeah, you're right. From the outset, there was some real uncertainty and some real perhaps rumors about what may have caused this. And the very first day, later in the day, we were able to get at least sort of one source to say that he was facing a federal charge, a fraud charge for allegedly embezzling this money. It's funny that I'll never forget. So I had that. We're sort of working to get more people to discuss that. We had a meeting, Steve and I and some editors, and I think Megan McDermott, who was very crucial to the early reporting with Steve on the school modernization program. And Steve, and so basically I knew there was an escrow account involved, but didn't really know much beyond that. And Steve says, I wonder if it could be Bud DeWolf, because he'd done the reporting on the modernization program and the DeWolf Epic issue there. And sure enough, he gets Bud DeWolf on the phone, confirms, some of it. I managed to get the second source. And at least that day, by late in the day, we had confirmed without the paperwork that the issue was this $800,000 to $1 million. Back then we were saying allegedly embezzled. I think why we felt so safe saying it with what you just read is because from the civil suit, that we can talk about later, the civil suits make very clear that the money was stolen from this escrow account.
Yeah, not only clear that it was stolen, but then was in the process of Mr. Nogay trying to pay it back. In fact, apparently kind of scamming another friend, which we will get to. But what I want to do is back up. And let's look at Jordan, the Kingdom of Jordan, an unlikely place for a story like this to go, but a fascinating story in which, Jordan wants this medical campus. Tell me about how this happened, Steve.
So Bud DeWolf is the architect in question, a fixture in Rochester for decades, very accomplished.
Is he a fixture in Jordan? I mean, Jordan, the country of Jordan wants a medical campus, they hire a Rochester architect.
After the story came out, I was talking to somebody about that, and I said, how did the world did that connection get made? And
yeah,
it was made through friends of friends, somebody that Bud had made the acquaintance of doing some work in the U.S., who had a friend that was Jordanian, and somehow word got back to the kingdom that, oh, here's an interesting architect. Why don't we ask him to put a bid in?
This was when?
This was in 2005, probably.
Yeah.
So Bud did bid, and the design, which I've seen and which they did begin to build, is a lovely and very, seemed to me, very suitable design. It has Middle Eastern echoes in the design. It's very approachable and human scale. Anyway, so he got the job, signed a contract, did the design. The king apparently loved it. They started work. Everything was fine. And then at a certain point, a dispute arose between the parties, between the architect and the project manager for the kingdom, and it got to the point where Bud stopped working and they stopped paying him, and over time the controversy boiled down to whether or not he would get this $1 million that was sitting in this escrow account.
Because the total deal, I think if I remember from the story, was $9 million?
It was $9 million, and several million of that had been paid out for work.
So they're doing the work over time. So they do some design work, some work happens. The Jordanians pay as they go.
Right.
But they're not paying Bud DeWolf directly. They're putting the money in an escrow account, and the man managing the escrow account is Bill Nogé.
Of course, Bill Nogé. It was put in charge of that. I understand it's not an uncommon thing in a big construction project to set the financing up this way. So there's a sort of a middleman that holds the money for a time until the project manager releases it or says that it's okay to pay it. And that arrangement worked fine until 2009, we've later discovered, when apparently Mr. Nogé began helping himself to that escrow account. By this time, the money was sitting in escrow, and I think he had a sense that he wasn't gonna have to pay it out anytime soon because the parties had begun their war of words about the fees.
That would last years, right?
It'd go years and years until it wound up in court here in Rochester. And so it's just the circumstance was such that that this money was there. I think Bill knew that because of this dispute that he wasn't going to be required to release it, and he just started tapping it for this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah, so backing up here, a couple of things here.
Okay.
And again, I know next to nothing about escrow accounts. I always like to admit what you don't know, and there's a lot I don't know here. So forgive my ignorance here, but I suppose if you're the one handling an escrow account, you can dip into it and steal from it without either party knowing? I guess you can, right? He did.
At least obviously in this case, I think the escrow agent, I mean, using this as an example, the escrow agent provides statements, but you're trusting the escrow agent that the statements are accurate, when the escrow agent statement says there's $1,054,000, as everybody thought there was here, that's true and that it's not a falsified document.
All right, so the scene looks something like this. DeWolf and the Jordanians had this deal. The work was proceeding. Then both sides basically start to be unhappy with it. The deal is canceled. You've got this $1,054,000 in the escrow account managed by Bill Nogé. And the Jordanians and Bud DeWolf start fighting over it. Nogé knows it's going to be in court for a long time. And as Steve Orr mentioned, as you read in the Democratic Chronicle report, Mr. Nogé not only starts taking the money, but I think your report mentioned he was using on everything from car repairs to, sort of everything, right?
Well, one of the things, and to back up one step, what happened after Bill died and we wrote the initial stories is there was no detail available at all about what he was accused of doing. And that's where we went to court. I think we've talked about this before. You know, the newspaper went to court and intervened in the criminal case and petitioned the judiciary to unseal the records. And that was a fairly lengthy procedure, but we won. So some months later, the records were released, the criminal complaint and some supporting documents that had been sealed. And that, among other things, those documents showed to some extent what Mr. Nogé did with the money, what they accused him of doing. And a relevant point, too, is one of the supporting documents contained a statement that in the course of his discussions with the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office, Bill had admitted and had signed a statement admitting that he had embezzled this money. So that's why we were able to use wording like about to be revealed as a thief, because he had, in fact, conceded that he was a thief privately to the FBI. So they laid out something of what he did with the money, but not the amounts. But they did say, yes, he spent money at a car dealer. He gave money to his kids. He paid his property taxes at least once. He sent some money to a company he was involved with in Pennsylvania. And then most notably, I suppose, he got himself elected to the New York State Assembly.
Used it for his campaign.
He paid for his one and only campaign to the Assembly in 2012, excuse me. Almost all self-funded. Almost all the money he spent came out of his own pocket. Our presumption is that most or all of that money came from the escrow account. that theft of money, diversion of money, embezzlement, whatever word you want to use, happened over a period of time from 2009 to 2013, according to the criminal complaint.
And he drained all of it, right?
At the time, the period of time accounted for in the criminal complaint ending in early 2013, by then he had taken $800,000.
Okay.
Our findings, looking at civil case records, is that the remaining $250 or whatever it was, $1,000, he took later. So by the time 2016 rolled around, I mean, in one of the cases, they obtained statements from this account. There was $56 in it.
$56.
Yeah.
Out of $1,054,000.
Correct.
That's what he did not spend.
Yep.
Okay. And I don't mean to laugh. I mean,
but you know, one of the enduring mysteries here is what he did with all the money. It's just not all accounted for. We don't know how much he gave to his family. We don't know.
Probably we'll never know. Do you think? I don't know how you'd know. You can't itemize it.
Well, yep. No, except that as we'll get to, there are civil cases ongoing, mm-hmm. and the lawyer also who's in charge of his estate has a duty and has begun executing that to look into his financial history because his job is to verify debts that Bill owed at the time he died and to also find assets that might be hidden away somewhere. So I think in the course of these, there'll be a lot of examination of his financial history, and maybe that will include determining where the purloined money went. We don't know yet.
Okay. And so, you know, I thought about many ways to work this hour just because what you're hearing from Steve Orr and Gary Craig from the Democrat and Chronicle regarding their remarkable reporting on Bill Nogé, the late Bill Nogé, and what he did in regards to these scams. I say scams, we're just talking about the Jordan deal. But there is more. I think what we should do is close the loop as best we can on Jordan, and then we'll talk about school modernization and some of these other issues. But, or maybe we shouldn't, because these other things start to happen, which may be the reason everything was crashing in on him, as the reporters noted in their piece, was it was almost coincidental that that a lot of this was starting to crash down on around Bill right around the time that he decided to end his life. You know, your reporting then takes us to, I think, school modernization, right? So, all right, let's pause the Jordan story, because now we know that $1 million plus Bill was helping himself to, probably hoping that we can't get inside his head. He's gone. I would have loved to ask him, did you think it would never come up? I mean, at some point, you're running an escrow account. There's going to be a decision on what to do with this money, and there's no money in it.
Well, you know, I mean, just not to get ahead of things, but there was a line that we thought about using in the story but didn't, could have, and that you could view this as sort of a slow-motion Ponzi scheme where he, you know, may have taken money from this escrow account, and as we'll say shortly, he tried to replace it with money he obtained improperly somewhere else, and maybe he had further plans to just keep obtaining money from other sources, legally or otherwise, to replace the money he'd already taken, which is sort of the essence of a Ponzi scheme. But we don't know. I mean, obviously, as you said, we'll probably never really know what the motivation here was.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, there is an amazing quote that did get in there. I mean, to me, the standout quote from the whole story was at that initial appearance before State Supreme Court Justice Rosenbaum in June of 2015, a lawyer for the Jordanians said, quote, "What happens, goodness forbid, if Mr. Nogé, you know, did something that with the funds that he wasn't supposed to?" And then added, "Not that Mr. Nogé would ever do that." And as Steve writes, the next line is, "He already had." That's amazing. When you discovered that quote, did you think, oh, my gosh? You're both smiling.
Oh, my gosh is a good way to summarize it.
That's an amazing quote.
You know, what was funny about it is we learned about this civil suit. And we can describe how that happened in a little bit. But that case was sealed also. We got access to it. Went over to go through the file, and I'm going through it, and I pulled this thing out. It was in the middle of a bunch of papers, and it was highlighted in yellow. And I'm like, okay, I guess I'll read it. It's highlighted in yellow, and that was that passage. And I'm like, who the heck highlighted this? And I thought, oh, the FBI has been through this file, and they did it. Or the judge went through the file after Bill Nogé died and he remembered this and he did it. Turned out it was just done coincidentally by another lawyer for reasons that had nothing really to do with Bill's alleged embezzlement. But that's brought it to our attention, is that because it had been highlighted with a yellow marker. But it was a bizarre coincidence that this guy, this lawyer, happened to say that, and he just plucked it out of thin air as an example. And I have corresponded with him, and he agrees that it was a bizarre coincidence.
Yes. So as a reporter, I just have to ask you, I mean, you get a quote like that, it falls into your lap. That's an amazing thing, because you're trying to explain a complex story to the public, but a story that really matters, a story about public corruption, a story about an elected leader who had different scams going. That quote was so crystallizing and so amazing. You know, I mean, you don't always get something like that, do you?
I mean, Steve had done the he had gone through the civil papers, and I'll never forget him sort of bringing back, and we'd review and showing me that quote, and I at first I almost didn't believe it. It's like, no, this isn't real.
There's no way.
Because you're right. I mean, as you said, it just crystallizes, and it's the essence of everything. What if the guy that we're trusting to watch over this money, and you know, he wasn't saying that he was just saying, what if? What if he's helping himself to it? And lo and behold.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay. So let's now, before we close off what happened in Jordan, or with the Jordanian deal and Bill Nogé managing that escrow account, there's a number of separate things, but the big other kind of side story, it's not a side story, it's school modernization, which, by the way, I don't want to lull anybody to sleep. The school modernization project is what? Give us a brief description, guys.
I'll defer to you. You're there.
Go ahead, Steve.
It's an ongoing $1.3 billion program, the part of the city school district in conjunction with others, to upgrade all of its schools, or most of its schools. Many big cities in the country, including Buffalo, Albany, Syracuse, have or are going through the same process. Bill Nogé comes into that is... this program is broken into phases. There were some questions and concerns about how the first phase had gone. At the beginning of phase two, when they had to hire a company to be the manager of the whole phase, a multi-million-dollar job. As we learned later and reported, Bill Nogé and other parties whose names have not been made public decided to start a company that would compete for this program manager job. Nogé told me his motivation was that they thought the first phase had not gone well, and they thought they needed a new company that could do it better in phase two. So the company starts. The titular head of it is Bud DeWolf again. Again, he and Bill Nogé were friends for decades, and Bud is still broken up over what happened. But his name keeps coming up in the story just because they were relatively close. So Bud DeWolf was going to head this newly formed company to get the school program or project. Nogé was involved. Other people were involved. And they won. They won. They were given the job. They were given the job with the backing of Mayor Warren, who has said repeatedly that she backed this company not because Nogé was involved or not because of Bud DeWolf or anything like that, but there was an African-American woman who was going to be one of the leaders of that company, and she thought she had met the woman, was very impressed by her, and wanted her to be involved mm-hmm. in this job.
Did the mayor know that Bill Nogé was involved?
That's, I would have to go back and parse exactly what I've written and what my notes show. If she knew he was involved, from what she's told me, it was only that he was peripherally involved. I think he was quite deeply involved. She has said she didn't know that.
Okay.
And that her motivation was strictly because this woman, Barbara Armand, was going to be involved, and that she really thought she would be a great person to be a program manager of the modernization undertaking. So she had supporters on the board. They voted 4-3 vote, and this company was chosen. Barbara Armand almost immediately quit. Emails were later leaked that showed that she quit because she didn't trust Bill Nogé, that she thought he was trying to take over the company, if you will, and do things that she thought were inappropriate, wrestle power from her, however you want to put it. So she walked. The whole deal fell apart. Somebody else was quickly chosen to get that job. You know, there were complaints. The company, it was called DeWolf Epic was the name of it. There were complaints made. They filed a little lawsuit that went nowhere. But at any rate, they were gone. They were out.
Listener Steve may be saying, okay, so what? So Bill Nogé was involved in a company, big money project. These kind of bids and contracts happen all the time. So what?
Well, that's a good question. So what? I know, I talked to him about it afterwards, and he said, oh, yeah, I was involved, and I was playing a peripheral role, and it wasn't that deep, and it was perfectly fine, and I had an ethics opinion from the Assembly Ethics Commission, and everything was on the up and up. But other people just didn't think so. I think there was an element of surreptitiousness in what he was doing. There were the board members that voted on this, at least some of them, had no idea that there was a sitting state assemblyman that was going to be involved in this company.
And standing to gain potentially a lot of money, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And there were some other things that went on with him helping draft some documents that he did, again, sort of under the table, and then people discovering his name on them. There was a certain amount of intrigue, and it was clear that he was trying to hide his role. And I think when anybody tries to hide their role in something, others might say, well, why is that?
What are you hiding?
What do they have to hide?
Yeah.
So as we discovered later, somewhat quite a bit later, those questions occurred not only to us, but to the FBI. And so in the fall of 2015, as we now know, the FBI began looking into DeWolf Epic and how it got this contract and what Mr. Nogé's role was going to be and so on. And that then led, in a secondhand way, to their further investigation of his embezzlement.
Yes, and I mean, I think, you know, this is reading a little between the lines, but I don't think it takes a brain surgeon to figure this out. They've said in their papers they were looking at bank records. So I think, you know, we could pretty much assume that the FBI, having stepped into this because of the whole DeWolf Epic issue and looking at the school modernization, starts looking at the finances for Bill Nogé and basically stumbles upon this escrow account issue. And while those who are trusting him with it are only seeing the statements that he's occasionally given, you know, through the powers they have, again, this isn't spelled out explicitly in the papers, but I don't think it's much of a reach knowing the way they work and knowing what the papers do tell us, that they see money going out of the escrow account. And I pretty much presume with the specificity of where they say money went, such things as Steve was talking about earlier, that there's probably corresponding, you know, on this day, Bill Nogé removes $30,000 from the escrow account. Lo and behold, a day later, $3,000 ends up here. So I think that's how you get, you know, this decision-making as to what he was actually using the money for.
So the FBI is digging in the backyard because someone told them there might be a dog bone, and they find an entire dinosaur skeleton that just happens to be there.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah. And they follow the money, like the classic old line, and it led places they didn't expect. And as an aside, I think that, you know, that investigation, despite Mr. Nogé's death, is the broad investigation is continuing. We reported in the story. We don't know who or what they're focusing on, but sources say it's a live investigation. And I think the logical conclusion to draw is that they may still be following money. I mean, that, you know, they can subpoena bank records and quite easily, I think, and you just don't know where that has taken them.
And I could say as recently as 2 weeks ago, I think, because you know you can get posthumous records through the FBI on people if they were being investigated at all. And I had filed for FBI records of Bill Nogé, and as recently as 2 weeks ago, it was denied under the exemption that if there was an ongoing investigation. That could hinder if the information came out.
Okay. So let me grab our first phone call. This is from Dan in Rochester with a question. Go ahead, Dan.
Hey, I just had questions like, what does the record show about the source of the $40,000 for the PAC Mayor Warren's campaign in 2013?
All right, so let's back up with a little, stay on the line, Dan, a little context here of what Dan's talking about. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah,
In the criminal complaint that the FBI filed against Nojay, there was a reference to money having been transferred to a lobbyist. The lobbyist was not identified. Our story did not identify the lobbyist. We don't know who that was to a certainty. However, sources have told us that part of what, to back up to where we were a minute ago, when the feds began, quote, following the money and looking at Nojay's financial dealings, they wound up looking at a political action committee that was started in, that operated really for just about a month in September of 2013 to support the primary candidacy of Lovely Warren then when she was running for mayor. That's as far as we got in our reporting. We, you know, we were told that there was an interest in that PAC. Yes. We don't know what that means. It may well be that simply because, and Bill, it should back up. We've reported previously the PAC was started by Scott Gatti.
Who was a lobbyist.
Mm-hmm. He and Nojay were friends and associates in different enterprises over the years. That PAC involved doing campaign work, mostly radio ads and literature for Lovely Warren, and the work was all done, as far as we could tell, by Bill Nojay and Scott Gatti. And Nojay was operating in his surreptitious way under a corporate name that attempted to disguise his involvement. But at any rate, but he was involved with that PAC or spending the money that that PAC had. Maybe that's what drew the FBI's attention to it. We don't know, but we don't. We're not suggesting there's anything illicit about what that PAC did.
Before I let Dan follow up, just a couple of points here. Do we know why a Republican Assemblyman, Bill Nojay, was supporting the primary campaign of a Democrat, a Democratic City Councilwoman, Lovely Warren? Do we know why?
You know, Bill often was a hard individual to pin down. So, I mean, his politics, he wore them on his sleeve, but, you know, he, you know, as far as he had an interest in the city, I think, you know, we run the story, he grew up in the city and he had an interest in the city. I mean, Steve may be able to better address this than I, but I'll maybe give him the benefit of the doubt and thought that he, you know, and he also, Bill has had a very good relationship with David Gant. I think they had a good relationship through many years, and you know, obviously Lovely Warren came out of David's office and was supported by David, so that may well have been part of it too.
Okay, so he may have been backing someone who was closely aligned with David Gant, whom he was close with. But we don't know for sure why Bill Nojay, a Republican, was interested in backing Lovely Warren. We also have no evidence that I have seen, and help clarify this, please, because we've mentioned Scott Gatti's name, we've mentioned Lovely Warren's name. We don't have any evidence that they knew he was involved in these illegal activities, right?
Right. I want to be too clear on one thing. We talk about sort of the sourcing. You know, it's
yes.
I mean, it's not just necessarily that we heard it through sort of different places, obviously, you know, that we felt comfortable reporting it as far as that was part of the investigation. Yeah, I mean, I would liken it to, you know, Steve and I have been friends a long time, and say Steve came to me with a business venture idea and said, you know, you have $10,000, and I had $10,000 I'd just stolen and gave it to Steve.
But he didn't know
Steve
that
invested.
You had just
that doesn't it. Make Steve culpable. Just as, you know, is the town of Pittsford supposed to know that Bill Nojay is paying them with illicit funds? I mean, I don't think
okay.
we can assume that anybody
knew.
Yeah, that they knew where the source of the money was.
Yeah, and specifically in this case, no, we have no indication at all at this point that anybody, including the mayor and the, Mr. Gatti, but anybody else, knew that he had pilfered this money and was spending it here and there. Maybe people did, but we have no knowledge of that at this point.
All right, Dan, you want to follow up with any comments or question there?
Yeah, I mean, for me, that just, like, raises a lot of questions. And, like, I don't know, where there's smoke, there's fire, where there's, like, a little bit of illicit money and going somewhere, you don't know that these people don't know where it's coming from. So, like, that's all I probably have to say.
Well, let me just respond in part because And Dan, I don't know your politics. I don't know if you have a dog in the mayoral fight, and I don't imply it, but I could tell you that one of the issues Steve and I have run into, I think, and correct me if you think I'm wrong here, Steve, is that there is this mayoral race this year, and a lot of people sort of want to sort of, you know, pigeonhole this into the mayoral race. And that's not something that we're trying to do. Personally, I'd like to keep the story sort of clear of as best we can. And I sort of worry sometimes that, and again, I'm not saying this is what's happening with you, but I do think there's some folks out there who are you know, basically using this for political purposes more than just really looking at the case as it is.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that certain things won't be investigated, checked out. As Steve and Gary mentioned, clearly the FBI is still working on things. It's hard to tell exactly what. But if we're going to be evidence-based and we're going to be fair, there's no evidence whatsoever that the mayor of Rochester or that Mr. Gaddy or that Bill Nojay's family or that Bill Nojay's friends, Bob Savage down at WISL, people who have known him for years, there's no evidence that anybody knew that he had a lot of these scams going, but he, as far as we know from the evidence right now, kept it to himself. Now, again, if that could change, but we have to be very clear on what we know and what we do not know. I see the phone ringing. I know you've got more questions on this. I do too, because we have to get back to how Bill Nojay tried to start paying Bud DeWolf back here. We're talking about more than $1 million. How did he do that? That was another twist in the story that I did not see coming. So let's get our only break of the hour and come back with Gary Craig, Steve Orr from the Democrat and Chronicle. If you missed their outstanding reporting on this, easy to find on democratandchronicle.com. We've also linked to it in multiple places on our social media accounts, and we'll be right back with more of your questions and ours. Coming up in our second hour, the annual End the R-Word Day is coming up. We're all being asked to take the pledge not to use the R-word. We're talking about language that can be very insulting to people with intellectual disabilities, and we'll even examine some recent cases in which people in the public spotlight did some harm with their language. We'll talk about it all next hour. Hi, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Shirley writes to the program and says, do you think he, quote, borrowed the money from the escrow account to invest, and then the investments didn't pay the money back, and he lost it that way?
I mean, he obviously had some business ventures, but I mean, it looks as if, you know, I mean, it's sad to say, when you look at the allegations, what he was spending it on, you know, taxes, some stuff for family, et cetera, that he did sort of take it as a personal piggy bank. You know, I think Steve hit the nail on the head when he mentioned sort of Ponzi schemes. That's the way a lot of Ponzi start. People believe that they're going to be able to find a way to cover this up, and ultimately they're just not able to get the money back in there when the time comes that they need to.
Okay, let me get back to your phone calls as well. Alice in Rochester. Go ahead, Alice.
Hi there. I had a question going back to Scott Gaddy. So he had involvement in Rachel Barnhart's campaign when she was running for assembly, and now that Rachel Barnhart's running for mayor, is this something that we should expect the same shenanigans from, or... Where does that connection come in?
Alice, I don't even understand the question, to be honest with you, and I'm not trying to be rude. I mean, what shenanigans are you talking about? We're trying to establish what we know.
In terms of the money that was invested into the mayor's PAC, and now he's working for Rachel, so where does the connection come in? Where does the connection between Rachel Barnhart and the mayor? Is it just Scott Gaddy switching sides, or what is the connection?
I don't know if there is one. Again, I think, as I said earlier, I do worry about sort of kind of shoehorning this into the mayoral campaign. You know, Mr. Gaddy's obviously able to choose whomever he wants to support. And I think, as we said earlier, there is no proof that people who may have received, and again, we don't even know if we can put him in that pool, may have received money from Mr. Nojay, knew of its illicit start. So I guess I can't even agree, perhaps, that there were shenanigans, sort of the start of it.
Yeah, Alice, I mean, again, there's a lot more to learn here, but I think Gary and Steve are wise to caution us to only talk about what we know and not necessarily leading us down the road of politics. We'll see. But you're right, we're in the middle of a campaign, so my guess is their reporting will eventually show up in campaigns. That's what happens. I'm going to grab one more phone call because it's on a question I also see on Twitter. Michael is asking about the DNC op-ed from David K. Johnston, a local reporter as well, who who responded to Gary and Steve's outstanding reporting with some of his concerns about a judge sealing part of the case here. And Mike in Rochester has a similar question, so I'll let them ask that question. Go ahead, Mike, and then we'll have Gary and Steve address it. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. By the way, I'm complimenting on that very, very well-written article on Sunday. But the thing that I found quite disturbing is that how come there's no comments about what the judge did in this case? And as I remember, from the article, he said something about not wanting to embarrass or expose a public figure at that time, and so he kept this investigation sealed even from the FBI at the time, and you had to fight like crazy just to get this unsealed. I mean, I think that's, I find that rather disturbing that, you know, that politicians and people in power seem to get breaks when, for instance, the individual who was on the news the other day about who rents stuff for children and he was caught on porno sites, his picture was plastered all over everything, even though he hasn't been convicted of anything, and I'm sure it's ruined his business. I mean, so it seems to me like there's some kind of a double standard here when it comes to this kind, these kinds of investigations from the judicial system.
All right, Mike, let me just jump in. First of all, I'd like to read a part of their actual report, if I could, and then I'll kick it over to Gary and Steve. I will also just say from my own perspective, and having worked in the news in various places, I think we're way too loose with the way we use mugshots to begin with, but I know you're talking about a separate case there, and that's a separate discussion on a different day. Let me go ahead and read from Gary and Steve's story on the section that Mike is bringing up here. Quote, as million-dollar lawsuits go, DeWolf versus escrow agent for a certain escrow account, as the matter was entitled, was dry as toast. It revolved around seemingly contradictory clauses in the agreements between Bud DeWolf and the Jordanian sponsors of the Cancer Institute. What may have been most unusual about it was that its very existence was concealed from public view until now. Shortly after the case was assigned to Justice Rosenbaum in the spring of 2015, he signed an order to seal the matter in consideration of the parties involved, the sensitivity of the subject matter, and in general, the interests of the public. There would be no public record of the case. All of the attorneys agreed to the sealing, with the Jordanians' attorneys apparently concerned about the possible release of proprietary information and Rochester area lawyers wanting to ensure Bill Nojay's reputation was not tainted by the litigation. He was a public figure, said John Dresty, one of DeWolf's lawyers. So moving the case behind closed doors was allowed under court rules, but nonetheless an unusual step for a civil action over money. Rosenbaum said he could not discuss litigation that he had ruled upon, end quote. So that's what Mike's talking about. Michael on Twitter also bringing that up. And David K. Johnston, the reporter who wrote the op-ed, saying that Rosenbaum should have to answer for this, that by keeping this behind closed doors, it might have prolonged the public finding out about all of this and protected Bill Nojay. What can we say about what we know about this decision from the judge?
Well, first, I'm glad you read the quote that it was actually Mr. Dresty and not the judge that said anything about we're protecting a public figure here, we thought. And, you know, this is a thing, this is an issue that I don't think I can tell you we completely have our arms around him. I think we have a situation from what we do know where you have the state Supreme Court Justice, you know, Matthew Rosenbaum, who the Jordanians apparently make this request for their own reasons, whatever they may be, for the file to be sealed. Mr. Nojay's lawyers, Mr. DeWolf's lawyers, consent from what they told us is, as said, you know, he was a public figure, and plus he was really accused of no wrongdoing here. He was basically named because, sort of for formality, the escrow agent needs to be named as the person overseeing the money. So their thought was, you know, let's not wrongly drag him into this. I have to admit, I can't sit here and give you the sort of the percentage of how many cases are sealed or not. I know since that piece was written, a couple of people have responded in the legal field and said, wait a minute, while more often than not it doesn't happen, there are cases, you know, similar where this does happen. Could you make the argument, well, perhaps you need to take an extra step of caution if there, I'm talking about not sealing it, if there is a public figure involved, and maybe that should weigh into the decision. I don't think we can necessarily read a ton of information into the decision at this point in time, if that makes
sense.
Okay,
and I think, you know, maybe the shorter version here, Mike, is that the judge might have been looking at this saying, this is between a Rochester architect, who's not a public figure, and the Kingdom of Jordan. Bill Nojay, who is a public figure, happens to be in the middle of it. He just happens to be in the middle of it because he's managing the account. He's not really involved in the dispute. And the public might be confused about his role, and he might be unfairly tarred by a dispute. And so why even do that? Let's keep it sealed. It would be unfair to him, you know, not knowing that the real story later was going to be Bill Nojay is draining this account for his own personal use. And by keeping it sealed, it actually maybe inhibited the public knowing that for a little while. It's possible. We're speculating, and it's probably unfair to Justice Rosenbaum to speculate. But I will say, if you read David K. Johnston's op-ed, you should also read Chris Thomas's response to that. Chris Thomas is a partner for Nixon Peabody, Full disclosure, he's a board member of WXXI. He also has done work for the Democrat and Chronicle as they have pursued unsealing some of these records. Chris has done a ton of First Amendment work. Chris wrote a response in which he basically said he thinks David K. Johnston was over the line in what he thought was an attack on the judge who has a very good reputation. Anything you want to add there, Steve?
No, other than, the one point that David K. raised that is of interest to us going forward is how often this really happens. Our inquiry so far has yielded a big, we don't know.
Okay.
There's no easy way to tell.
Yeah.
We'll try and find out because I think there are questions about whether that was an appropriate thing to do or not, and it'd be interesting to see what other cases it's been done in.
Sure.
If the answer is it happens all the time, that doesn't mean it's justified. I mean, if that turns out, that's a whole issue unto itself.
That's right. I mean, they've kept cameras out of the courtroom in New York State all the time. That doesn't mean that's justified. No, my disposition is if you're going to keep something out of the public eye, there better be a really good reason for it. But there's still a lot we don't know about what the justice did and why there. But Mike, I suspect we may see that continue to be a question that is asked. I'll grab one more call, and then we got to get to this amazing, this interesting story of how Bill Nogé tried to pay the money back and ended up in even more trouble. But Robert in Fairport, go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It was a great article. There was a lot of work that went into all this analysis. And I guess one of my questions is, does the newspaper have people that are skilled in forensic accounting to kind of dig deeper into this? Because there's like two things that sort of stick out from this. The first is the use of that Florida shell company for some of this campaign literature and advertising. It makes me wonder if the reporting requirements in Florida are a lot more loose than they are in New York State. And the other thing is this school modernization project. It just sounds like a rat's nest there that needs to be kind of examined more closely. His involvement there was only revealed after someone looked at the Microsoft Word document notes. So he was trying to keep his involvement secret there. It just begs for more investigation.
Thanks, Robert.
And I mean, I'd just like to, again, commend Steve and Megan McDermott were ahead of the story. They were looking at the very sort of issues that you're talking about last year when they're writing about school modernization long before we knew later of FBI involvement, et cetera.
Here's a very good question from Tim that came in via email. Is it now the responsibility of Bill Nogé's estate to pay that amount of money that he stole back? Well, let's talk about how he's trying to pay it back, or he was trying to pay it back before he died, and now then the question of what kind of recovery could happen. So he's got this $1 million plus that he knows he owes. A judge finally says, this is over, Bud gets the money. And the Jordanians stop fighting it, right?
Yes.
And Bill at that point knows there's 56 bucks in the account. I've got to come up with $1 million plus. Uh-oh. So he asked for a little bit of a delay or asked the judge to kind of reword it, which was an interesting little sidebar to the story. The escrow agent saying, can you reword that, judge? Take as much time as you need. I write that a different way. But he gets the order. You got to pay it, and he knows he can't. Gary, what did he do to try to start paying it back?
Well, I mean, as we were doing the reporting from the civil suit, we spoke with the attorneys in the case and learned from them. And, of course, we later, there's other records that now bear this out, that basically once it was ordered that the money be released, a couple of days later get a call from Mr. Nogé's attorney saying he's got $700,000 he's going to give you. He doesn't have the full $1,054,000. He's going to turn himself into the Bar Association or whatever, the grievance committee, and give up his license. So, of course, then the question becomes, wait a minute, apparently where did this $700,000 come from? And through some work, Steve and I were able to sort of find out that he had basically gone to a friend, a businessman, Les Cole, and obviously told him something that's probably, I'm sure he didn't tell him, I need to replace stolen money, and basically convinced him to give him $700,000, which he then turned around and paid to Bud DeWolf, to try to, and said, the rest you may get later. That now, we've written about the different court actions. I mean, there's now a surrogate's court action, on behalf of Mr. DeWolf trying to recoup the other $354,000. And there's at least the initiation of an action, correct, by Mr. Cole that may lead to full-blown litigation for the $700,000.
So, I'm sorry, though. Again, guys, did Mr. Cole know why he wanted that $700,000?
No, we don't know. We don't know exactly what Mr. Nogé said to Mr. Cole.
To get him to give that money.
To get it was in the form of a loan. But the in the paper, the legal papers that Mr. Cole has filed so far, he has described the transaction as he now believes a fraudulent one. And, you know, our understanding is that essentially whatever Nogé said, it was something that was not true. And he obtained that money under false pretenses. And that's why Mr. Cole's lawyers are now, as Gary's, they haven't filed a claim, or at least the last time we checked, they hadn't, to recoup that $700,000. But they were in the process of, they were leading up to that, filing preparatory papers and so on. So, yeah, what's going to happen now is Bill Nogé's will has been filed, a case has been commenced, his estate is open, or whatever the wording is, in surrogates court here in Monroe County. The obscure but in this case important public administrator person, which is an appointed position in every county in New York that handles the estates of people who don't have anybody else to administer them. In this case, the executor named in Nogé's will didn't want to do it. So the public administrator, whose name is Frank Iacovangelo, appointed by the county government, is in charge of administering his estate. And like anybody's estate, the obligation is to close out the person's business affairs, pay any bills that are due, collect any money that's owed, and then turn whatever's left over to the, you know, whoever the deceased has bequeathed his estate to. So that's now Frank Iacovangelo's job, but first and foremost. And he will defend the estate against all these various lawsuits that are being filed, demanding, you know, DeWolf has one in, Leslie Cole may file one. I've talked to several other parties that Nogé owed money to who said, how do you spell Iacovangelo again? Because they're probably, if they haven't already, they're going to be filing claims. So it's going to be a very prolonged legal mess for him to untangle. And again, one of the questions remains, what did Bill do with all that money? Did he spend it all? Is there some of it still tucked away somewhere? And if so, then Frank Iacovangelo has to find it, and that would then become available to repay money that is owed. So, but as we pointed out in the story, one of the horrible ironies of this thing is that, you know, he essentially stole the same money from two different people at two different times. And now they're going to wind up in surrogates court, theoretically, fighting each other for that money. Mm. And it's just a sad state of affairs. It really is.
It is. Jackie writes to the program and says, following up on the forensic accounting question, is someone looking into other state legislators who may have had access to or known about or participated in Nogé's scheme or the cover-up? We don't know that anybody else knew, right?
No. I mean, yeah, we just don't know right now. I mean, there's who knows what the coming months will show, but we don't know that right now.
Yes. And on Twitter, you know, we're hearing from, let's see here, Mark says, Evan doesn't, the callers don't seem to like your caveat that this is a no judgment zone and political smoke means fire. Well, I know it's going to be politicized, Mark. I get that. But I don't always judge fairness in the best way, but I do my best. And if you want to say that Lovely Warren or Scott Gatty are tied to this in some way, you don't have evidence for that right now. Now, again, there's probably still a lot of reporting that has to happen, but we don't know that, and we could never say that, and I stand by that. I'm not going to apologize for that. What I want to do in the last minute or so is just ask them, what are the big questions still unanswered? For obviously, the FBI ongoing investigation, but Steve, what still has to be answered out of all of this? Or still could be answered,
well, it could be what happened to the money is one. Mm-hmm. Another question could be if there were, in fact, other parties that knew what Bill was up to, knowingly accepted stolen goods. And the third question, to be honest, is whether there was other money that he misappropriated. The exact same thing is alleged to have happened with $1 million that Bill and three other people allegedly sweet-talked an investor in Cambodia out of.
A dentist, right?
A dentist. I mean, that's another whole story.
Oh, my gosh, I didn't even get to Cambodia.
But it's another $1 million that passed through Bill's legal escrow account here in Rochester and was lost in the wind.
And now the dentist.
And other dentists
in Cambodia
has gotten obtained criminal convictions against these people. By then, Bill had died, so he was not convicted. And there's a civil suit.
So there's a lot that can still happen. And I think, fair to say, guys, this from 5 months ago to today, this has become a bigger story than you expected. Is that fair?
Oh, very much so.
Amazing work. And I just want to thank you both, because we sat here months ago listening to some people in the public say, let it go. And I'm just really proud of the work that you guys have done for this community, tracking this, spending the time. You know, and I said it on Twitter, I'm just going to say it right now. For all the haters who think that we don't need newspapers anymore, have you subscribed to the Democrat and Chronicle? Does this matter to you? Gary Craig, Steve Orr, thank you for this.
Thank you, Evan.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, short break. More Connections next.